from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
The new day is on the horizon.
No, I like Oprah. I don't think she's going to run.
The fallout from Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury, inside the Trump White House, continued over the weekend. President Trump on Saturday called the book boring, untruthful, and described himself as a very stable genius.
A federal judge in California has ruled that DACA must remain in place for now. That coming on the day that the president held a televised immigration meeting with top Democrats and Republicans at the White House.
This should be a bipartisan bill. This should be a bill of love. Truly, it should be a bill of love, and we can do that.
But the reality is the NRA has too many senators and too many representatives in its pocket.
You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266, as we talk about the week's news. You can always comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us, Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Good to see you, Kalila, and Happy New Year.
Great to be back. Thanks.
And also Happy New Year to Chris Powell. He's the outgoing managing editor of the Journal Enquirer. Maybe spend a couple of moments talking with him about that decision. Chris, very good to see you once again. Thanks for joining
thanks
us.
Thanks for the invitation, John.
Well, we're going to start where we ended that little montage with Governor Dan Malloy. As we heard, he's once again challenging the gun industry. Malloy on Tuesday called for banning the so-called bump stock device that allowed the Las Vegas shooter to fire hundreds more bullets than he could have otherwise with a conventional gun. This is one of the steps that some states have been looking to as the federal government doesn't grapple with gun control in some of these key areas. And it's also, I think, Colin, we'll be talking about a few stories that line up together. Really a key piece of the legacy that Governor Dan Malloy wants to leave behind.
Right. So 2018 will be many things. But one thing it'll be in Connecticut, it'll be Dan Malloy's kind of stroll down the farewell path. And that kind of stroll, particularly for a person like Dan Malloy, includes things that he would like to be part of his legacy and things that he hoped to accomplish. And those are not always the same things. I mean, there's quite a bit of overlap, ideally, between those two things. But so there are things you want to be known for, and then there are other things that you basically just think you ought to get done. And this is in both categories. Dan Malloy's life changed, I am comfortable saying, on the day of Newtown, what he saw there, what he experienced in his close contact with the bereaved families, changed him forever. And so there's nothing really political about this. He really does believe that every possible measure should be taken to limit the kind of damage that can be done to civilians by firearms, and that'll be probably part of his legacy. Ex-governors in Connecticut, they tend not to be like ex-presidents. I mean, you don't really see them that much afterwards. But I wouldn't be surprised if Dan Malloy in his private citizen life stays involved in the gun issue. I wouldn't be surprised to see him sitting on boards of gun control organizations or playing some kind of activist role. Now, this should be easy to get passed in Connecticut, even given the kind of narrow margins that exist in the General Assembly. You should be able to get something. This looks like common sense to me. Now, having said that, I'm probably wrong.
And before I get Kalila's take really quickly, I will say at least one recent Connecticut governor you probably didn't see so much of because he was behind bars
right.
during a
large portion. I'm talking about the ones who are at large.
Oh, okay. The ones who are actually at large. They're either in Florida or they're spent some time in prison. I thought about this part of the Malloy legacy, Kalila. And again, as Colin said, Governor Malloy, nobody wanted to have what happened at Newtown in their lap. But this has clearly been his number one cause since that day.
And I think as much as we like to criticize politicians, there are some things more important than simply winning an election. And I think this is one of those issues for Malloy where he feels an obligation to address. And I think in many ways, it reminds us of what Mike Bloomberg did in New York City, of going against the party, going against what lobbyists and advocates were saying to say, look, I don't have another race to run. I don't really care what it means for the party, this is something I feel compelled to address. So I would expect that once Malloy is out of office, we may see some Bloomberg-Malloy alliance on a comprehensive approach to gun reform at the local level, but more importantly, at the state levels as well.
Chris?
Oh, I don't think there'll be too much opposition to outlawing bump stocks. If you go on YouTube, you can see the only real legitimate use for them seems to me to be blowing pumpkins apart. I don't know, that's terribly compelling, but most of this gun stuff on the state level to me seems like a distraction, John. You can outlaw bump stocks in Connecticut, but as long as they're legal somewhere else, somebody's going to bring it in if he wants to do some, you know, horrific damage. I think a lot of this gun stuff on the state level is a distraction, and I think it's mainly a distraction from the failure of state government and federal government to address the poverty problem we have. You know, we'll have, I'm sure, more gun fatalities in Hartford and, you know, Bridgeport in 2018 than there were in the Newtown massacre, and nobody cares about that.
Well, and Governor Malloy and many others have pointed out for quite some time, Chris, exactly what you're saying, which is that whether or not it's a cheap handgun that's used on the streets of New Haven or Hartford, or whether it's a bump stock or some sort of high-powered device, it is probably coming in from another state like a Virginia, like someplace down south, in which the rules for how you can acquire a gun are much different.
Yeah, I mean, that's really why the gun issue is going to have to be addressed nationally, but, you know, more so, I wish we could someday have a discussion in Connecticut as to why there's so little gun crime, say, in Avon and Simsbury and so much in Hartford. Gun laws are the same in both places.
Tell me more about that. What do you mean by that? What would you like that conversation to include?
I think it's a matter of demographics. It's a matter of government's failure to alleviate the poverty problem. I think the poverty policy, welfare policy is perpetuating poverty and despair and demoralization. I don't think it is improving our demographics, and that's why, you know, people in Avon and Simsbury and Wilton seem to be able to behave in regard to guns, and people in, you know, poor places don't. But we just do not have a discussion in Connecticut about the failure of poverty policy.
Well, I think one of the things, particularly for Connecticut, is if we look at rates of domestic violence acts that involve guns, it's not concentrated in our cities. It's often in suburban areas, in rural areas, where people do have access to guns within their homes and are using them in these ways. So I think if we want to have a comprehensive discussion about who is most likely to be victimized in our state when it involves guns, we shouldn't pit cities against the suburbs, but really look at what are those underlying factors. For me, it's one of access and also the ease of access.
Yeah, I'm uncomfortable threading all those problems together. I think they need to be broken apart. And the problem with poverty is poverty. In other words, the reason to address the issue of poverty is that poverty in itself is a blight. What its exact connection is to guns and gun violence, I think, is tougher to trace. I'd rather have those conversations separately.
Let's turn to another little piece of Governor Malloy's legacy. He also announces this week he wants to nominate Andrew McDonald as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, something we've talked about in the past, Colin, not terribly a surprise to us. He's long been a political and personal ally of Governor Malloy, but it also sets up, I think, another way in which we can talk about the Malloy legacy, in which he would be nominating the first openly gay Chief Supreme Court Justice, Andrew McDonald, already the first openly gay Supreme Court Justice in the state of Connecticut.
Yeah, so there's a lot in this. And I do, it's always worth pausing and just thinking about what's changed in your lifetime. I became a journalist in 1976. This whole thing was just, you know, it couldn't have happened then. I'm thrilled that we can reach a point where we have an openly gay Chief Justice, and I'm amazed in a very positive way by the changes of that kind that have taken place in my lifetime. Yes, as you say, this was a layup. Dick Palmer is and will continue to be the intellectual leader of the state Supreme Court, but he's probably a little bit too old at this point to be a good choice for Chief Justice. And this is kind of an administrative job, too. People forget that. It's not just sort of legal scholarship and judicial leadership among the members of the Supreme Court. You kind of are running a good-sized operation. And so that's a different skill set. Andrew probably has that more than a lot of his other colleagues on the court. The choice was a layup. I will say a couple of things here. One of them is, first of all, he's coming under fire right now for Peter Wolfgang of the Family Institute of Connecticut and Tim Herbst. This is mainly in the case of Herbst over capital punishment. We talked about this last week. Wolfgang's criticisms are probably a little bit more broad. This, in turn, occasions a broadside from William Tong and the Democratic side, suggesting that there's an ugly, and by that he means homophobic, quality to this criticism. I just, first of all, would say that One of the problems here is that although I think Andrew McDonald will be a fine Chief Justice, it's not great appointing politicians to the Supreme Court, right? People whose – I mean his main career has been as an elected politician. And you know, when you do that, you politicize the court a little bit more. You make confirmation hearings more political than they need to be. And they're already too political. Dick Palmer had to go through this kind of weird gauntlet in his last reconfirmation hearing that was completely unnecessary and absolutely political, and there's no point in doing that kind of thing. But you're going to have more of it if you appoint people who are essentially their main career is elected politicians. You're going to have more of this stuff, and I don't think it's good for the court.
Chris, I'll take you next. What do you think of that?
I don't think that people ought to be appointed Chief Justice because of their sexual orientation. I certainly am delighted that we don't care about those things anymore. In fact, I think we haven't really cared about them for decades in Connecticut. But the objection to the appointment of McDonald is issues. It's his positions in court cases and political issues. And I get the strong impression that the Democrats do not want to discuss these issues and court decisions, that all they want to talk about is the nominee's sexual orientation. I think they want to foreclose discussion of, say, the death penalty case and the political record of McDonald in the legislature. Those things are certainly arguable. And I think Tong's accusation against Herbst Herbst's criticism of the nomination was bigoted was completely false and dishonest. I think the Democrats, all they want to talk about here is sexual orientation. They don't want to talk about the political issues that will be decided on the court.
I think it's pretty fair to say that I don't think that he's being appointed to this position because of his sexual orientation. Is that what you're saying that
did you read the perception? You read the governor's press release yesterday. It was a very big deal to the governor to point out his nominee's sexual orientation. It came up twice at the top of the release. And even more extraordinary, the governor's office followed it up with a press release containing the endorsement of McDonald's nomination by, you know, 17 prominent political people and legal people. I don't see releases like that from the governor's office, you know, very, very often. I mean, I truly don't care about his sexual orientation. I suspect that 99% of the people in Connecticut don't care. I would like to have a discussion of the death penalty case.
Mm.
So I've spent the last few months of my sabbatical writing a book about identity politics in the U.S. And what's always curious when we talk about the ways people align themselves is, you know, this shouldn't matter. A layer of one's identity shouldn't matter. And we're at a time when the Supreme Court has said that a Mississippi law allowing government and businesses to discriminate against people who are part of the LGBTQI community because it conflicts with their religious beliefs, that can stand. We have a vice president in the White House who has supported these religious freedom laws. So clearly identity matters. I do not think that we should say that people get appointed or they get jobs or become figures solely because of that identity. Often they ascend to those positions in spite of the challenges they face there. We should have a real conversation, a critical conversation about his decisions, about his positions, and how we think that will affect his time on the court. That does not mean that we assume he has no value simply because others see this as a win for the state to say, in spite of all these challenges, people can still succeed.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Chris, I have to say that when you say something like that, the implication has to be that you think that had Andrew McDonald not been gay, somebody else would be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And I think that's kind of crazy talk. I mean, I don't think there's even a logical candidate anywhere else. I think Andrew McDonald would have gotten this appointment because more because Molloy knows him and trusts him, because he's young enough to stay in the job for a while to do the job. And as I said before, because it's an administrative job, he has a little bit more chops than that. I mean, I just think it's kind of crazy to say that he got it. When something happens that's historic, and this is historic, it makes sense to pause and take note of it, and take note of it through a press release or whatever. It doesn't mean you made the appointment because somebody was gay. And as to the capital punishment thing, I don't know. This came up also in Palmer's reconfirmation. You know, in general, when we confirm justices, We look basically at their credentials, their background, you know, and it's usually not a great thing when we start talking about issues and, you know, about sort of the specific positions they have, unless they have weird outlier positions. But this was a majority opinion. You know, this wasn't some weird, freaky thing.
It was 4-3. It was very narrowly divided.
But it wasn't some weird, freaky thing that some strange little justice somewhere has this opinion that doesn't, like, fit in anywhere else. Yeah, it was a 4-3 majority opinion. It's settled law. So, I mean, the notion that Andrew McDonald should have his feet held to the fire because he has this, you know, boutique opinion about capital punishment is absurd. It's a majority opinion. It's not some weird little thing that he needs to be called on the carpet about.
Well, I'll get into that opinion and why I think it was dishonest if you want, but I'm not saying that Malloy nominated McDonald because of a sexual orientation. I'm saying that the nomination is being defended on that basis when that's a complete distraction. Malloy nominated McDonald because he's a longtime pal and because he's a judicial activist who can be expected to legislate from the bench in a liberal way. That's why the governor nominated McDonald. He didn't nominate him because of his sexual orientation. However, the Democratic defense of McDonald's nomination is to distract from the issues of the court and the political issues and to try to settle it on sexual orientation.
I'll give you that. I think Tong went too far in going after Herbst. I think Herbst is all about the capital punishment thing. I don't think it's – yeah, I think Tong was a lot of line.
I think we probably shouldn't wade into these waters and not spend just a moment here. So clarify your position on this, Chris. As we talk about the actual death penalty ruling, what are your specifics on that case, as Colin says, on this narrowly decided case?
That case held that the death penalty in Connecticut had become unconstitutional because the public's opinion had changed and now held that capital punishment was cruel and unusual. In fact, the law that had been passed was a compromise. It was a compromise that eliminated death sentences for the future, but purported to guarantee that the sentences already ordered would be carried out. Why was the law passed that way? Precisely because the legislature knew that capital punishment maintained majority support among the public. But the court ruled that the law signified that the public was against capital punishment and considered it cruel and unusual. It's completely dishonest.
Well, I have to say, as someone who is very active in the movement to abolish the death penalty in Connecticut, particularly on behalf of murder victims' families, who said that that was something not only out of touch with public opinion, but undermined this idea of redemption and fairness, it was a much more difficult dance there in terms of what would happen prospectively and what would happen with those current cases. I don't think it's a bad thing to say that public opinion evolves or that the statutes and laws we have should reflect that. But I don't think that was the only reason that the court was offering that it needed to change in Connecticut.
I just want to take a quick phone call here. Ken's calling from Hartford. Hi, Ken.
Hi. How are you all today? Happy New Year. And I just want to say, Mr. Powell, thank you so much for your service to our community. But I just really want you to take your suburban light elitism and ride off into the sunset happily. When I hear you say that murder in Hartford is worse than in the suburbs, what you fail to acknowledge is that, A, New Haven's murder rate is down this year. B, like, the suburban-dominated legislature creates these policies that drive resources away from the city and perpetuate poverty. It's not the welfare state. And beyond that, John Paul Stevens wrote a very strong, very, very strong opposition to the death penalty in the 1970s. It was outlawed in the 1970s. This is we're a barbaric country that continues to outlaw people or continues to maintain the death penalty and not outlaw it. We're an outlier in Western nations.
Thank you again. Ken, I'd just love to give Chris a chance to respond. Chris, quick thought?
Yeah, but I'm not advocating capital punishment. I'm criticizing the rationale for the decision in the Santiago case.
A last thought very quickly before we take a break. You also wrote, though, Chris, recently in an op-ed about, you know, another piece of Governor Malloy's legacy. He's talked about it as he was running. He's talked about it through two terms. He was left a really big old mess in terms of debt here at the state, and he's been trying slowly to address this problem.
Yeah, last week he issued a press release reporting that the administration had fully repaid the more than $1 billion in borrowing that the administration of Governor Rell and the General Assembly took out in 2009 for current expenses. I mean, bonding for current expenses used to be considered immoral. Well, Rell and the Democrats in the legislature handed the governor $1 billion debt when he took office 7 years ago, and he got stuck repaying that. And I think it shows that he was handicapped by his predecessors just as he is going to be handicapping his successors.
I want to take a break. Chris Powell is here. He's the outgoing managing editor of the Journal Inquirer. Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University. Colin McEnroe from WNPR. We'll be right back in the wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join us, as always, to talk about the week's news, 860-275-7266. We are joined today by Chris Powell, the managing editor of the Journal Inquirer newspaper, Kalila Brown-Dean, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University, and our own Colin McEnroe. What's on your show today, Colin?
We're doing a show today about awkwardness and about the power at times of awkwardness. There was a great deal of conversation about 3 or 4 weeks ago about a short story in The New Yorker called Cat Person, which everybody seemed to read and talk about and have an opinion about. And one of the elements of this was about a young woman who was ultimately going to have, essentially consensual sex with a man she'd been on a date with, mainly because it was too awkward to tell him that she really didn't want to anymore. Mm. And that kind of got us thinking about just how powerful awkwardness is at times.
So we're going to awkwardly talking about awkwardness this afternoon on the Colin McEnroe Show. Now, if you love The Wheelhouse, you'll be interested in another event that's coming up, looking at the stories behind the biggest stories of 2017. It features many of our Wheelhouse regulars, Christine Stewart of CT News Junkie, Dan Haar, who now works for the Hearst newspapers, Mark Pazniokas of the Connecticut Mirror, and our newest WNPR reporter, Vanessa De La Torre, will be part of this panel as well. It's Tuesday, January 16th from 5 to 7 at the Lyceum in Hartford. You can find more information on our Facebook page. The event is sponsored by the Connecticut Foundation for Open Government, and I hope you can join us there. Quickly, before we get into some more state politics, a big announcement this week, Colin, out of Pfizer. Of course, this is the big pharmaceutical and research organization that has had many jobs here in Connecticut over the years, not as many as it used to have. They basically said, look, our trials for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's treatments have cost us a lot of money. They haven't really gone as planned. And we're going to get out of that business. The sort of small story behind that is several hundred jobs to be lost in Groton, Connecticut, and also in the research area around Boston. But there's kind of a bigger thing at play here, too, when Pfizer says, you know what, we just can't find the Alzheimer's drug we want, and so we're going to get out of a business that could potentially help millions and millions of Americans.
Yeah, I think this is a layered story, and I'm reluctant to come up with a glib assessment of it. I mean, on the one hand, the optics and the timing aren't great. I've shocked Chris by suggesting that I'm unwilling to be glib. Chris did a spit take when I said that. The timing and the optics aren't great. It's following, obviously, the Republican tax cut. One of the arguments at the time was that if you make some more money available to corporations, they'll plow it into R&D.
Just pour it right back into R&D. Yeah, that's right.
And stuff like that. And instead, you've got Pfizer saying, well, no, actually, we're not going to do that at all. But I don't know. That's the glib thing, and I'm not really 100% comfortable saying that. The truth is, these drugs are really hard to come up with, and a lot of big companies have tried really hard. I mean, it is the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. If you can do something about Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, of course, I mean, what is this, like 5 million people right now? I mean, really, if you could have an effective drug, you would make a lot of money. And so I kind of think if they could do it, they would do it. A lot of big companies have tried and failed. Almost every drug that's been pushed out there on the market hasn't shown any demonstrable effect on memory or any of the things you want to accomplish. The brain's a really complicated thing. This is, by its nature, an unusually complicated disease. You know, one thing Pfizer's doing is putting quite a bit of money, I think, in sort of a venture fund where they're going to basically dole it out to smaller neuroscience research firms, and I assume participate in the equity of that. And, you know, maybe that's a better way. Maybe some of these firms are more creative and nimble. The big pharma giants don't seem to be having much luck dealing with these problems.
I was just thinking about this, though, Kalila, in the context of, I remember near the middle of the second Obama term, I can't even remember exactly the timing of this, but there was a talk about kind of a cancer moonshot, you know, that that Vice President Biden was going to oversee, and that we were going to just double down on our ability to cure cancer, which is, of course, something that, unlike Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, drug companies have been actually making some really great progress on. But it does get us thinking once again about, you know, what's the role of all of us in trying to solve problems like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's? Is it about Pfizer deciding this is good for us, our bottom line, our shareholders, and we're going to make money at this, and we're going to put money into it this way? Or is it a bigger societal issue that we should be talking about?
I think it's a big societal issue, and it's one that should not – I've seen some reports lumping this into why it's hard to do business in the state of Connecticut. This is not about that at all. Pfizer has been, since 2012, really concerned about its drugs failing. And it may create a space where other companies, other scientists say, if Pfizer is leaving this space, then let's really step up our efforts to do that. So it could be the injection that we need to make some progress here. It's important for an area like New England that is really graying, and we're seeing the effects of Alzheimer's in people's lives much earlier, much sooner, and more widespread. So it is a collective way for people to say, we know this will touch nearly every family. What can we do to kind of inject the same level of funding into Alzheimer's research as we do with other things like breast cancer?
John, at my age, I just take pills, and I can't even remember half the time why I'm taking them.
You're taking lots of pills.
But I'm pretty sure this is not something we can blame Governor Malloy for.
It's okay. So there you go. I think we
that's one.
We all can be in agreement on that. Let's turn to actually a little bit of state politics before we get into some big national issues here. We've been talking a lot, Colin, about the race for governor. Of course, there's a secondary race now with George Jepson getting out of the attorney general race. Now we have some people deciding that they're going to get in to run to be the top attorney in the state. Are you finding this interesting so far in terms of the people who are getting into this race?
I am, but I have no life, so I don't know that anybody else would find it interesting. So, I mean, there's a calcification that goes on in Connecticut politics, worse than in most places. You don't get a lot of movement in many, many cycles. And so right here now in our so-called constitutional officers, Malloy's gone, Wyman's gone, Napier has just announced that she's gone, Jepson's gone. So this is unusual to have these kind of spaces to move into. So you've got a lot of people. Many of them have been waiting a long time to be able to do something, William Tong. And then others are interested very specifically. I mean, Claire Kindle, for example, who's just announced that she's a Democratic candidate for this spot, is actually somebody who works within the Attorney General's department already. So she's kind of proven that she's interested in being Attorney General. She's also got some political background, some political chops. Was on the West Harford Town Council, I believe. So, I mean, you've got a kind of a mix. But what you do have suddenly are a lot of people – I haven't even begun to name them all on the Democratic side anyway, exploring this possibility. Chris Matty was another person who obviously was part of the gubernatorial pack and then dropped down, I think appropriately, to the attorney general line when this became available. You know, on the Republican side, there's so far, to my best of my knowledge, one candidate, somebody who declared right away, a guy with some background as a U.S. attorney and as a state legislator.
I'm wondering quickly, though, Colin, if I can extrapolate from our earlier conversation about whether or not it's good to have, you know, politicians on the bench as part of the Supreme Court. I mean, what about a role like attorney general? If you have people like Claire Kindle or Chris Matty who seem to be less political and more like lined up to be attorneys general, does that necessarily, in your mind, discount some of the people who are also qualified? And again, everyone should check to make sure under the Bicewitz rule that they are qualified to run for attorney general, but who are qualified but are coming from a much more political position, someone like William Tong, who has been looking for something, as you say, kind of no matter what it is.
Well, Chris and I, because we are old and take pills, have seen quite a bit of evolution of this. So Chris and I both go back to a time when this was just sort of I hesitate to say meaningless, but it was not a particularly meaningful job, and it was kind of a political plum. So if you go back to – I mean, no disrespect to Carl Ajello, a fine person, but I mean, it wasn't really even a great job, really. And so then Lieberman got it and turned it into, you know, a real platform for doing stuff, a high-visibility job, an activist job, as Chris would say. Blumenthal carried on this tradition. It was suddenly a really great job and one that could be, on the one hand, a political platform for a whole bunch of ideas and also something that was very appealing appealing to the people of Connecticut, this idea who, to steal Mike Boguslawski's slogan, a guy who was in your corner, you know, a guy who was going to protect you from some toy that was going to explode in your face or something. So that's been the evolution. And then Jepsen kind of dialed it back a little bit. I would say Jepsen is not been as high visibility a guy, probably brought it back a little bit more to being the lawyer of the state. Not to say that he completely depoliticized it or anything like that. So I think we're maybe on the cusp of some – I mean, if it turned out to be Claire Kindle or Chris Matty, they would be political, but they would be maybe bringing a different kind of chops to all this. I mean, I should say Dick Blumenthal had background as a U.S. attorney and stuff like that. It wasn't like he didn't – like he was just a politician who got the job.
Yeah. Chris?
Yeah. In recent decades, the attorney general's job has been kind of like a shooting fish in the barrel job. You just put out – press releases announcing the, you know, Connecticut share of the national settlement in this lawsuit or that lawsuit. I think that's too bad because there are some pretty important issues here, and I wish the press would put to these candidates some questions such as, you know, what do they think about this, you know, school financing case that's going to come back before the state Supreme Court and, you know, potentially screw up the state's finances even more than they are right now. We've got the chef business is still bubbling along in the court system, and I don't think there's ever been a more catastrophically expensive disaster than the chef business. It was supposed to integrate our schools. Well, you know, we spent billions for magnet schools, and we don't even have 50% integration in Hartford. And as far as integration in the other towns, it's not even on the table. I think the AG candidates ought to be asked about issues like that. Anybody can put out a press release saying that, you know, we just got $140,000 out of a lawsuit that was brought by, you know, 50 state attorney generals. Big deal.
But and I will say, Kalilah, contrary to what Chris is saying, it seems as though the role of attorneys general in the United States as a whole is actually shifting away from that, looking at state issues, looking at things that might actually matter in Hartford or Bridgeport or Avon, and really signing on to some of these big cases in which they're going to be affecting federal or national policy because they're defending states' rights against whether it's a Republican or a Democratic majority in Congress that seem to not care as much about the states as they care about sort of getting things done for themselves.
And I think we're going to see that more, especially this year and the next 2 years on things like net neutrality, immigration, you know, marijuana enforcement, that kind of pushback, not just against the U.S. Attorney General, but also reclaiming this notion of states' rights in the context of voting rights and whether states get to determine for themselves what those things look like. So I think Connecticut cannot accept the status quo of what has always worked for us or what has been done these last couple of years. I think attorneys generals across the U.S. will now play a more visible role, particularly as Congress and the president sort of set a path that can have a negative impact on state economies.
Right. So Claire Kindle, in declaring, laid that out right away, that she sees her biggest mandate is to overturn or fight back against Trump policies, net neutrality, immigration, stuff like that. So I do want to say one thing about the attorney general in Connecticut, which is it's sort of a weird job because you have a lot of discretion except when you don't. So we all remember the famous moment where Blumenthal found himself on stage with Roland, who was popping some champagne over – was it Chef? Yeah, it was Chef. You know, and so Blumenthal looking wildly uncomfortable. I mean, you're the lawyer for the state sometimes in cases where your role doesn't reflect your inclinations at all. So it is interesting and important to know basically what their attitudes are about some of these pressing questions that Kalilah and Chris have outlined. But they don't always get to walk the walk they want to walk anyway.
But before we take a break, Colin, you had mentioned this other race as a challenge on the Democratic side last week just a little bit. But I know you kind of wanted to expand upon some of the interests that you have in Andy Fleischman, a 12-term representative in the state, getting a challenge.
Right. So I think primaries are really good, by the way. I think primaries are good for both parties. It helps, you know, it helps people not get too comfortable in their jobs. I think new blood is good, too. I look at a case like this. So Andy Fleischman is I think, in his 12th term now. He's got a primary opponent, a Democratic primary opponent, a young woman named Jillian Gilchrist, I believe. And in the coverage so far, I mean, this may change, but in the coverage so far, what I note is that Andy, who was interviewed by Ronnie Newton, said that he'd had a conversation with Jillian and he'd asked her whether or not there were votes that he'd cast that really bothered her, and she said no, she couldn't really think of any. So this is really more a primary about A, you know, I want your job, which is totally legitimate. You know? But I prefer primaries where you say, I want your job and I know I could do a better job than you're doing right now. I don't think that's kind of the tenor of this, but it might also, it's a little bit of, and I'm a woman and I'm young and it's sort of my time and it's, you know, and I get that. I really do get it. But on the other hand, you sort of look at a person like Fleischman, who I think has been a really good legislator. I'm sure Chris disagrees. But I think he's – I would say the same thing that Jillian Gilchrist said. I can't think of a vote Andy ever cast that bothered me. So, you know, I sort of think, you know, I have two value systems that are kind of clashing right now.
Hey, I don't think I've ever, you know, kicked Fleischman over anything. I think
I was just guessing. I was intuiting.
No, I think he's probably thoroughly predictable. But then the woman who's challenging him would probably be thoroughly predictable. I think I would ask them, well, you know, what do you stand for? How do you differ? Maybe they've got something, intelligent to say.
Well, I think it connects to our earlier conversation about McDonald, right? That people don't get appointed to these positions simply because of their identity, but you also can't use that as your only credential for why people should support you. So, yes, she can talk about how she brings something different to that office, but it has to be substantive and policy driven. And I think that if she actually enters the race, we'll see that, but it does raise this bigger point about how people use that as an entree into politics.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to close our show today with a conversation about two people who a couple of years ago we probably wouldn't have put in the same sentence. Steve Bannon, Oprah Winfrey. We're going to talk about that coming up next in the Wheelhouse with Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, Chris Powell from the Journal Inquirer, and our own Colin McEnroe. I'm John Dankosky. This is the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation 860-275-7266 as we talk about the week's news with our own Colin McEnroe, with Chris Powell from the Journal Inquirer, and Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University. All right, I'm going to put two people together that we don't usually talk about together, both because they had big weeks in a different way. First, we're going to hear from Oprah Winfrey. Here's a much acclaimed speech she gave at the Golden Globes. This event, of course, once a year, is kind of a drunken Hollywood party that's captured for television audiences. This year, a bit more sober affair because of a lot of what's been happening in Hollywood, starting with Harvey Weinstein. So here's Oprah Winfrey accepting an award and giving a speech that I think a lot of people said may have launched her in a different direction.
The new day is on the horizon. And when that new day finally dawns, it will be because of a lot of magnificent women, many of whom are right here in this room tonight, and some pretty phenomenal men fighting hard to make sure that they become the leaders who take us to the time when nobody ever has to say, "Me too," again.
So that's part of Oprah Winfrey's speech. And I don't know, Kalila, I'll start with you and just get this, get a little bit of the feeling that has come after that, you know, Oprah and others talking somewhat openly now about, well, maybe this points to a run for president down the road. I think many people have decided to formulate opinions on this already because we've got nothing better to do than formulate opinions. But also because, look, we've got a guy who is in the White House right now who is really a reality television star. And he had some other baggage behind him. Oprah Winfrey is someone who has put on television programs for years. She's also a philanthropist, a movie maker, and a lot of other things. But, I mean, how seriously do you take, after that speech, calls to draft Oprah to get into a presidential race?
So I think it speaks to this angst amongst the American public of wanting something different or someone different, not just in the White House, but really in politics in general. When you think about the general malaise amongst the American public right now, wanting that kind of energy and inspiration in the White House again, or in politics in general is totally a separate question from qualification, or for me, the most basic question is interest. Is this something Oprah even wants to do? And I think, you know, the most basic qualification, she's over the age of 35, native-born American citizen, she's been a resident at least 14 years, she meets those basic qualifications. So hearing the discussion about why Oprah would be bad, that to me has been more alarming.
Okay, and I want to get back to your thoughts on this, Chris.
Oh, well, I don't doubt she'd be a better president than what we have now, but, you know, Soupy Sales would be a better president than what we had now. Is he still around?
He's dead, actually. Right? He'd still be a better
even
president.
So,
he doesn't
even
meet those basic qualifications that Kalilah just so clearly laid out to us 30 seconds ago.
Even so.
He's over 35.
But I'm afraid all this is just the trivialization of politics. Maybe it's what we deserve, but it's just too depressing for me to talk about.
Well, Kalilah is right. People are incredibly thirsty now for something better than what they've been drinking. But when you're walking through the desert and you're really parched and you're thirsty, that's the time when you might drink out of the wrong water hole, right? You want to be very careful where you drink. There are a lot of things that I admire about Oprah Winfrey, but I mean, I think if she ran, she'd have a lot of questions to answer. And you could even start with that speech, which has been justifiably acclaimed as a great speech. It's also kind of an illustration of how Hollywood still doesn't have its story straight about this stuff. Whenever somebody like Matt Damon says, well, you know, nobody knew about Harvey Weinstein, he gets torn apart, you know, and everybody says it's an open secret. Well, I mean, there's this now widely circulated picture of Oprah Winfrey kissing Harvey Weinstein on the cheek in 2014. She's had a long association with Harvey Weinstein in lots of different ways. So which is it? Was it an open secret where everybody knew that this guy was the devil, or did nobody know? And so you go from there to, I mean, I said this on social media. This is our top government job. It shouldn't be somebody's first government job. I think we're seeing right now the consequences of that. I do think that Oprah Winfrey's, at least she's either really enjoying like listening to people kind of talk this through, or she's somewhat interested. I don't know which, because otherwise she could have shut this down, right, in the last 2 or 3 days.
Sure.
And I would have admired Oprah Winfrey a lot if she had said, you know what? You need to look at the Kamala Harrises and the Kirsten Gillibrands and the – or pick, you know, the Castro – I don't – pick somebody. The Castro brothers. I don't mean the people. You know, you need to look at people who spend their life preparing for this. You've got to stop looking at celebrities, you know, for your leaders. I mean, if that's not how she feels, obviously there's no need for her to say it. I would have been a lot more pleased to hear her say something like that, because I think it's true.
Yeah. It's just, okay, Kalilah, go ahead.
I think it's one thing to say it, right? And inspired speeches are admirable, but action is even more important. And I think that if we look over the last 10, 15 years, Oprah has done that. Cory Booker would not have a national profile but for Oprah Winfrey saying, come into this circle in this space and let me network you to a Mark Zuckerberg or get to know these people who can invest in Newark. Barack Obama would have been a failing state senator in Illinois but for Oprah Winfrey saying, let me connect you in this way. The same for Senator Kamala Harris and so many others. So there is a way to play that role of producer in the background that often has a bigger impact. And so for me to separate out, you know, did she know about Harvey Weinstein? Well, there are plenty of pictures of people with Bill Cosby that we don't sort of say the same thing there. So it is an interesting question about, is she interested? But more importantly, what is it that we want to see, not just from politicians, but from celebrities with a public platform?
Mm. Chris?
Well, you'll see if Oprah Winfrey wants to tell us what she stands for, and you know she's got a right to. But I'm sorry, John, I think this whole issue is so phony. You know, I'm sure if there's photographs of Oprah kissing Harvey Weinstein, there's actually video of Meryl Streep giving a standing ovation to Roman Polanski years after he raped the 13-year-old girl and was out of the country fleeing his sentencing. This was okay with people for a long time. And when, you know, Oprah Winfrey said in her speech, well, let's see, I got here, for too long women have not been heard or believed if they dared to speak their minds, speak their truths to the power of those men, but their time is up. Well, wait a minute. The women knew what was happening here. Hollywood has been notorious for the predation of its casting couch since movies were invented. And Actresses decided to play along with it as the price of wealth and fame that they wanted. They were going to pay that price. Not believed. The moment any, you know, several of them got up and criticized Weinstein, they were instantly believed. I mean, today you can accuse a man of any sexual misconduct anywhere and be instantly believed. All you had to do was speak up and stop playing the game.
I really don't even know how to respond. I think that to suggest that women were complicit in that harm and just accepted it as the cost of doing business is not only wrong, but it is detrimental to what is happening of people saying they didn't remain silent because they accepted it, but because they knew that there was a backlash. When you look at the women who have come forth to talk about Roy Moore, so move out of Hollywood and however people feel about that. The women who accuse Roy Moore, her house was burned down last week and people questioned what was that really about. You have women on college campuses who speak out against those accusers. And today we know that one of the young men convicted of sexual assault is allowed to finish out the semester because they didn't want to harm his career beyond college. So it is a scourge in our society that we say people don't take ownership for that. And I think about this in the context of how my conservative friends respond when I talk about my fear whenever I'm pulled over by law enforcement. Well, if you do nothing wrong, you have nothing to worry about. So if that is the case that we expect in issues of racial discrimination or allegations of misconduct, why does that not hold up in the case of sexual assault and harassment?
Yeah, I think, Chris, where your formulation falls down is that there was a long history of women being punished, not simply like not getting the job at that particular time, but women being punished by powerful men. So, I mean, when the two young comedians came in and to the hotel room and Louis C.K. wanted to masturbate in front of them, I mean, they felt as though if they made a big deal, I mean, even they did go, I believe, and talk to some people about this, but the bigger deal they made about it, the worse it would be for their career. So why should that ever have to be? Why should it? I mean, the thing that you say is true, that the women weren't willing to make a stink because they wanted the jobs. Why should that ever be the case? That's evil. It's evil that you have to risk your employment in any field, not just acting.
Of course it is, Colin. I'm not saying it should be that way. I'm just saying that Hollywood has been notorious for this since movies were invented. Norman Mailer wrote a novel about it in the 1950s, the Deer Park. Everybody knew and everybody accepted
it. But I don't think people knew how pervasive it was. And certainly what we know about Weinstein now is he had ways of punishing people for making trouble that went deep, deep, deep into their careers. It wasn't just not getting that one job.
And I think the benefit of this movement now, of moving from not just Me Too, but Time's Up, is to say, let's not just focus on Hollywood. Let's talk about domestic workers who realize it's not just about not getting a job. It is about being deported. It is about losing your livelihood and your family. So let's not just focus on Hollywood. Let's think about everyday interactions and occupations where women's lives are at risk because of this.
Because we just have a minute left, and maybe it's appropriate, Colin, that we left a minute at the end of the show to talk about Steve Bannon. I mean, look, a year and a half ago, most people in America didn't know who Steve Bannon was, kind of a fringe right character who ran an online news service. He gets drafted by now President Trump to help him win a campaign. He does. He becomes briefly the most powerful man in Washington, maybe the most powerful man in the world. Now he's out of the White House. He seems to be disgraced within his own party. He's out of a Breitbart job. And everyone from mainline Republicans to the Trump administration is calling him names and getting far, far away from him. My goodness, that's quite a change.
You know, when the book Devil's Bargain came out by Josh Green, there was a lot. I mean, there were reports that Donald Trump was upset because Steve Bannon was the star of the book. And there's been a sort of little question between the two of them, like who's the star, who's driving the stagecoach. And I think you got your answer. You know, Donald Trump is driving the stagecoach. Rebecca Mercer is the key name to all this. She has funded a lot of these causes to the extent that Steve Bannon has been able to live whatever life it is that he wants to live. It's been with the Mercer money. And when the Wolf book came out with those quotes in it, she pulled her money out of a lot of Bannon stuff. And usually it is about the money. It's about the money this time. That's why Bannon finds himself on the outside.
Well, maybe he can always go back to Hollywood. Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show, Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, and Chris Powell. Thank you so much, Chris, and congratulations on your retirement. It's very good to see you one more time.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
This is The Wheelhouse.